From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama says treaties obligating the U.S. to defend Japan include disputed islands in the East China Sea. A security guard opens fire on Americans at an Afghan hospital. An official says Ukrainian forces have taken back a building captured by pro-Russian separatists. A lawsuit claims the U.S. no-fly list violated the rights of some Muslims. It's all ahead on International Edition. Sitting in for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest. U.S. President Barack Obama has reassured Japan that the U.S. will abide by its commitment to help defend the country if China seizes a disputed group of islands, but says he's not setting a red line that would result in the U.S. attacking Chinese forces. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with the president in Tokyo.
President Obama came to Japan offering reassurances that the Japanese leadership has been wanting to hear. Tensions remain high over the islands in the East China Sea that Japan administers, but that China claims. At a briefing with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, the U.S. leader said the United States intends to uphold a decades-old mutual defense treaty in the case of the islands, known in Japan as the Senkaku and in China as the Diaoyu.
The treaty between the United States and Japan preceded my birth, so obviously this isn't a red line that I'm drawing. It is the standard interpretation over multiple administrations of the terms of the alliance, which is that territories under the administration of Japan are covered under the treaty. There's no shift in position. There's no red line that's been drawn. We're simply applying the treaty.
Mr. Obama comes at a time when confidence is shaky among many Japanese who see the United States' failure to make good on its threats to attack Syria and its reluctance to provide lethal aid to Ukraine as signs that the U.S. may not come to Japan's aid against China. The president is starting a week-long tour of Asia meant to show U.S. allies that the administration's promised pivot of its diplomatic efforts and military forces to Asia remains on track. He will also visit South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. In his conversations with Prime Minister Abe, Mr. Obama encouraged Japan to speed up negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a multinational pact that would create one of the world's largest free trade zones. The deal is held up by a dispute over Japanese agricultural tariffs. On Ukraine, the U.S. leader said he is getting ready to impose new sanctions on Russia for not following through on the commitments it made in Geneva last week to de-escalate the crisis.
We have been preparing for the prospect that we're going to have to engage in further sanctions. Those are teed up. It requires some technical work, and it also requires coordination with other countries.
The president heads to South Korea next. Tensions there have been heightened by indications that North Korea may be planning another nuclear test. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Tokyo.
The U.S. Embassy in Kabul says several Americans were killed today in an attack at a hospital in the Afghan capital. Afghan police say a security guard opened fire at Western Kabul's Cure Hospital, which is run by a U.S.-based charity group. At least one of the dead is a doctor. An Interior Ministry spokesman said the security guard is now in police custody and an investigation is underway. Ukraine's Interior Minister Arsen Avakov says police have driven pro-Russian separatists out of the city hall in the eastern city of Mariupol. Avakov said in a Facebook post today that city officials were free to return to work. The government also says Ukrainian forces repelled an attack by armed separatists on an army base in the town of Artemivsk. Ukraine says it is relaunching what it calls anti-terrorist operations against pro-Russian forces that have taken over government buildings in about a dozen eastern cities. The separatists are demanding the right to vote on whether to split with Ukraine and join Russia. There are an estimated 40,000 Russian troops stationed just across the border from Ukraine, but as VOA's senior correspondent Andrei Dineshner reports, there are indications some Russian troops are already on the Ukrainian side of the border.
Western experts say the Russian troops along the Ukrainian border are poised to invade that country if Russian President Vladimir Putin gives the order. But John Schindler, a specialist on intelligence at the U.S. Naval War College, says there is already one conflict going on, what he calls a special war.
That is a strategy for using power in a somewhat covert or clandestine manner, espionage, subversion, even terrorism, in a way that is not fully transparent, in a way that, you know, using overt military forces is very much what the Russians are doing in eastern Ukraine right now. They did it in Crimea before. They did a great deal of this in Georgia in 2008, leading up to their major military intervention.
Before Mr. Putin annexed Crimea last month, pro-Russian militia took over government buildings on the peninsula and asked for Moscow's support. Russian military authorities denied any links to the masked gunmen. Kerr Giles heads the Conflict Studies Research Center, an organization that tracks the Russian military. He says there is no doubt Russian soldiers were on the peninsula at that time, despite attempts to make them anonymous.
They took off all of the unit patches and so on from the uniforms, but they were not all particularly careful about that, so some still had, for example, name tags attached to their body armor. Tracing those through Russian social media, you can work out exactly which unit they're from and find out that actually they departed for Crimea at the end of February.
Now that Crimea is in Russian hands, the focus has shifted to predominantly Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. Russian officials are once again denying that Russian troops are in Ukraine. But Kerr Giles says there is no doubt about their presence.
The Russian forces in Ukraine are making a much greater effort to be less obvious than they were in Crimea. So they're trying quite hard to look disorganized and less well-trained, and also intermingling much more effectively with the local units that are supporting them, as opposed to Crimea, when there were very distinct groups of Russian servicemen and the local mobs that were on their side.
John Schindler from the U.S. Naval War College says Russian forces have been in Ukraine for some time.
For weeks, there have been GRU, that is Russian military intelligence special operators, roaming around eastern Ukraine and also southern Ukraine. Some of them have been caught in the Odessa area as well. These are, you know, relatively small groups, 10, 20, 30 individuals in each group running around, raising local supporters, distributing guns, money, etc. This is exactly what GRU does. They're very good at it, and they've been laying the groundwork for this for some time.
Schindler and Giles say there is evidence that special forces that were in Crimea are now in eastern Ukraine. Schindler says Russian covert operations have increased under President Putin, a former Soviet KGB agent.
Putin has created a state where the intelligence services, which are his, of course, original base of power, have enormous influence on decision-making and strategy-making in a way that no Western state has.
And if you don't understand that, says Schindler, you don't understand how Moscow and the Kremlin operate today. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Australian authorities say debris that washed ashore in the western part of the country is not related to a missing Malaysian jetliner. The unidentified material was found near the coastal town of Augusta. A search for the plane is taking place, although heavy rain, strong winds, and large sea swells are hampering today's search. A lawsuit claiming the FBI violated the First Amendment rights of four Muslims by placing them on the no-fly list has been filed this week in U.S. federal court. VOA's Bernard Schussman has details from New York.
The United States is accused of violating the rights of four Muslim men living in the United States by placing or keeping them on the no-fly list after they declined to spy on local Muslim communities in New York, New Jersey, and Nebraska. Ramzi Kassem, associate professor of law at the City University of New York and supervisor of the Creating Law Enforcement and Responsibility Project, says this is a major constitutional issue.
They don't want to work for the FBI. They have a right not to do that. If they don't want to go into communities and engage with those communities pretending to be something they're not as informants, they have a right to decline to become informants. And if they believe that their religion prohibits them from spying on innocent people, as our clients do, then they have a right to...
Qasem says this case is precedent-setting. In the complaint to the court, the plaintiffs, Mohammed Tanvir, Jamil Al-Ziba, Naveed Shinwari, and Awais Sajjad, said the government violated their right to travel freely and wrongfully stigmatized them without justification and without due process by placing them on the no-fly list. Qasem told VOA how the FBI allegedly approached each plaintiff individually. One, Awais Sajjad, says he was offered U.S. citizenship and compensation for becoming an informant.
Some of our clients were approached for questioning by the FBI, but these FBI agents would come and start asking them questions about their communities, not related to any specific crime, and then they would offer them the opportunity to work for the FBI as informants. Our clients would refuse, and the next thing they knew, they were placed on the no-fly list. The no-fly list is supposed to be about aviation safety. That is the reason that the U.S. government has said it has created that list. But what we're seeing here essentially borders on extortion.
The plaintiffs at different times wanted to visit family and, in one case, a spouse in the Middle East. The FBI would not comment on the lawsuit. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
The United States is defending a decision to allow some military aid to flow to Egypt, despite concerns that the country's promised transition back to democracy has been anything but smooth. VOA's Jeff Seldon has more from the Pentagon.
Egyptian police in Alexandria responding to protesting students with tear gas and buckshot. Clashes like this one that have some questioning why the United States is agreeing to send 10 Apache attack helicopters to Egypt. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren.
We've identified a very significant mutual national security interest. It is in our interest, it is in America's national security interest for Egypt to continue battling terrorism in the Sinai.
David Shanker, director of the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute, told VOA via Skype the terror threat is a growing concern.
The insurgency in the Sinai is booming. This is ungoverned space. The Bedouin and the residents of the Sinai have long been underserved by the government of Egypt.
Shanker says the Apache is Egypt's weapon of choice in fighting the growing numbers of Al-Qaeda-linked militants in the Sinai, but that Egypt may have found a way to help force Washington's hand.
They also have some Russian helicopters, and I think that the notion that they're going to go out and procure more Russian helicopters with Saudi money is something that they've said and that is said is currently being negotiated, also prompted the transfer right now.
Analysts say the move could also help ease tensions between Washington and Cairo, even as the U.S. pushes Egypt to follow through on the promise of free and fair elections. As for assurances Egypt will not use the helicopters against civilians, the Pentagon's Colonel Warren had this to say.
Well, we continue to dialogue with them and to ensure that they do obey it.
Warren notes the U.S. has turned down Egyptian requests to move ahead with transfers of F-16 fighter jets, M1 tanks, and Harpoon missiles, which he says are not needed in the fight against terrorists. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Officials from around the world are meeting this week to discuss protecting the world's oceans amid climate change and overfishing. The Global Oceans Action Summit for Food Security and Blue Growth is being held in The Hague. The summit runs through Friday. VOA's Joe DiCapua has our report.
Summit organizers estimate 40% of the world's population lives within 100 kilometers of a coastline. Nearly 700 million people live in low-lying coastal areas just 10 meters above sea level, and 13 of the world's 20 biggest cities are on the coast. What's more, up to 12% of the population relies on oceans for their livelihood. Netherlands Agriculture Minister Sharon Dijksma is chair of the Ocean Summit.
For most of history, man has had to fight nature to survive. In this century, he is beginning to realize that, in order to survive, he must protect it.
She says protecting the oceans is necessary, with global population expected to grow to 9 billion by 2050.
Are we really willing to stop the moral outcry that still almost 1 billion people go hungry to bed every day? Are we willing to stop the overexploitation of our natural resources, especially fish stocks? We, as global leaders, ocean practitioners, businesses, scientists, NGOs, civil society and international organizations have to find answers to these questions the coming days.
Dijksma says that combined action and partnerships for healthier and productive oceans can drive sustainable growth and shared prosperity.
Let's face the facts. 80% of all life on the planet is found in the oceans. The ocean provides a global life support system that helps regulate climate and supplies half of the planet's oxygen needed for one in every two breaths that we take.
She says food security cannot be maintained without sustainable fisheries.
Fish contributes 17% of the animal protein consumed by the world population and thus is a critical source of food, with demand expected to double in the next 20 years.
The three major threats to ocean health are overfishing, habitat change, and pollution. However, Dijksma says efforts to eliminate these threats often have been unsuccessful. That failure, she says, contributes to tensions between growth and conservation. World Bank President Dr. Jim Yong Kim addressed the summit with a video message, saying oceans are fundamental to life. Kim says over the past decade, the bank has increased its support for fisheries, pollution reduction, and habitat conservation. In other words, support for what's called blue growth.
For example, we're working with Sierra Leone in Liberia to reduce illegal fishing and make catches sustainable. As a result, local communities have increased their catches by as much as 40%. In the Pacific, we're partnering with several countries and regional agencies to support smart limits on tuna fishing, which could increase local revenues by $250 million each year.
Also addressing the conference was Arne Mathiesen, the Food and Agriculture Organization's Assistant Director General for Fisheries and Aquaculture.
There are many good reasons why we need to push the blue agenda forward. The health of our planet itself, our health and food security, depends on how we treat the blue world. We cannot keep using marine and aquatic resources as if they were endless. And we cannot keep using our oceans as a waste pool.
He says oceans are rapidly losing biodiversity. Many regions report a sharp rise in invasive species, threatening local marine life. He says FAO programs aim to strengthen local fisheries to better manage and maintain fish stocks. Mathiesen says countries, agencies, and organizations at the summit need first to commit and then to act. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Kenyan officials say a bomb attack outside a police station in Nairobi late Wednesday killed four people, including two police officers. The incident came in the midst of a countrywide security crackdown against illegal immigrants and terrorist suspects. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
Police investigators worked into the night Wednesday, poring over the twisted and charred remains of the car destroyed in a powerful explosion outside the Pangani police station. Shopkeeper Bosco Mugendi was serving a customer from his kiosk directly across the street at the time of the blast.
It just went off. I heard a big sound, like a thunderstorm. Then I saw something like fire and smoke, which gave me a big blow. Then I ran outside. I didn't even remember to close my kiosk.
Two police officers were killed in the blast, along with the driver and another passenger. Community police official Patrick Lumumba said the police officers were inside the car that was carrying the explosives, having pulled it over earlier for driving on the wrong side of the road.
The two police officers entered in their vehicle, followed by our patrol car. And as they were coming to the police station, it seems as if they had already put on everything ready. And at this place is when they detonated.
Lumumba suspects the bombers may have been planning to attack a live television event taking place nearby, but were diverted by the two officers.
The police are doing a good job, and we still cannot relent. We want the police to continue. The only thing we will advise the police is when they suspect any vehicle, we need a thorough check even before the vehicle is taken to the police station.
Kenyan police have been conducting a major security sweep targeting illegal immigrants across the country following recent attacks blamed on Somali militants. Pangani Police Station has served as a detention center for suspects caught in the dragnet, many of them from the predominantly Somali Eastleigh neighborhood. Detainees have complained of poor conditions and police abuse taking place inside. On Twitter, Inspector General David Camayo mourned the loss of the two officers and said the police will not relent in their fight against terrorism, writing, "I fully declare war." Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Young Ethiopians are eager to benefit from the economic growth of the last few years, and since the market has so many opportunities, everyone seems to be working on a startup idea in the hopes of making it. Marta Vandervolf has more for VOA from Addis Ababa.
Around the capital city, Addis Ababa, young people sit with their laptops in any hotel lobby that offers free Wi-Fi. Many of them will tell you they are working on their latest startup idea. With a large population of young adults and one of the fastest growing economies on the African continent, many Ethiopians are trying to figure out how they can start their own business and benefit financially. ICE Addis is an innovation hub that supports tech startups. Co-founder Marcos Lema says that young entrepreneurship is big in East Africa, but relatively new to Ethiopia.
Our actually basic requirement for startups to recruit startups is the first one that we check if it's actually an innovative idea for Ethiopia. And the second one is like is that idea will be sellable. And so that actually like the startups will get enough market to sell it in the country or outside. Most of the startups we are supporting, they are fourth-year students or like recently graduating.
But since the idea is relatively new to Ethiopia, startups face a lot of problems. Among them, a lack of financing, the absence of tax breaks, and a poor telecom sector. Marcos says that is not all.
There is also like some licensing problems also. Like if you start something really innovative, like it's a very long process.
Stefano Skiflu is an architect graduate and co-founder of a construction website, Kinehinsa. ICE Addis supported them by maturing the business concept and promoting their ID. Stefano says the website will be up in a few weeks, but the process has taken more than 2 years because of a lack of financing.
So far, I mean, we've really tried to look for funds, like for our startup, but it was not really feasible. So now we're working on other like income resources through our other skills and trying to start this company like on our own.
A group of three young Ethiopians is currently registering their own startup that tries to tackle this financing problem. This startup is a micro investment firm that will provide small loans to people trying to start a business. Co-founder Emmanuel Grundur says small loans are rare.
Basically, the majority of investment is large. It's, you know, in millions of dollars. But someone in Deborah Zates who might want to start a chicken incubator, he might not need millions of dollars. He might just need $5,000 to $7,000 to start up.
Millions of Ethiopians still live in deep poverty, but the government is set on turning the nation into a middle-income country by 2025. The International Monetary Fund projects the economy will grow by 7.5% in the next fiscal year. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Well, that's it for this time. Thank you for joining us today on International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. Sitting in for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day. This is Today in History. According to tradition, on this date in 1479 BC, Thutmose III ascended to the throne of Egypt, although he shared power at first with his mother. During his reign, Thutmose created the largest empire Egypt had ever seen. Also, according to tradition, this is the date in 1184 BC when the Greeks entered Troy using the Trojan horse. The story goes that after a fruitless 10-year siege, the Greeks constructed a huge wooden horse and hid fighters inside. When the Greeks pretended to leave, the Trojans dragged the horse inside their city, which was then destroyed when the hidden troops emerged. In 1704, the first regular newspaper in America, the News Letter, was published in Boston, Massachusetts. In 1877, the last of the federal occupying troops withdrew from Louisiana, thus ending the period of Reconstruction in the occupied southern U.S. states following the Civil War. As a result, white Democrats came to rule the region, and black Southerners saw their rights steadily decline. In 1916, the Irish Republican Brotherhood started a rebellion in Ireland. The demonstrators wanted to end British rule in Ireland and establish an independent Irish Republic. In 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched from the Space Shuttle Discovery. The telescope was named after the astronomer Edwin Hubble. The telescope has since taken spectacular pictures of the universe. In 2005, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger was inaugurated as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, taking the name Pope Benedict XVI. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a meeting called by the French ambassador to the United Nations, representatives of the Security Council were shown horrific photographs of victims of the savagery the Assad regime has unleashed in Syria. The photos were among 55,000 reportedly smuggled out of Syria by a Syrian army photographer, codenamed Caesar. Appalled by the atrocities he saw at three detention centers, he fled the country, carrying the photos out in flash drives hidden in his shoes. The photos show emaciated corpses, some with their eyes gouged out, others the victims of brutal beatings. One of the authors of the report accompanying the photographs, former Sierra Leone Special Court Prosecutor David M. Crane, compared the gruesome pictures to images from Nazi concentration camps. He also said they were just the tip of the iceberg, since they came from three government detention centers and about 50 are known to exist in Syria. French Ambassador to the UN, Gérard Ardault, is preparing a resolution authorizing the International Criminal Court to investigate crimes against humanity in Syria. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, said the perpetrators of the crimes shown in the photographs must be held accountable. The gruesome images of corpses bearing marks of starvation, strangulation, and beatings indicate that the Assad regime has carried out systematic, widespread, and industrial killing, she said. We owe it to the Syrian people, including Caesar, who has risked everything to bring these images to light, to ensure that the perpetrators of crimes against humanity are brought to justice. The day before the ghastly photographs taken by Caesar were shown to members of the Security Council, UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay released a report by her office also condemning the rampant use of torture by Syrian authorities. The UN report drew on 38 interviews conducted by UN investigators over the last 8 months with individuals released from detention centers. Our findings confirm that torture is being routinely used in government facilities in Syria and that torture is also used by some armed groups, Ms. Pillay said. More than 150,000 people have been killed since Bashar al-Assad first responded with brutal force against peaceful anti-government protesters 3 years ago. The evidence of the savagery taking place under his watch offers incontrovertible testimony to why Assad can hold no legitimate place in Syria's future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.